AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm here again with Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
And Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And joining us today is Joe Reed. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
And if Joe is here, you know what that means. It's time to predict the 2022 Oscars. We are doing this the week after the 2021 Oscars, although I'm pretty sure in like adjusted pandemic time, it's been a month since the Oscars. I'm not sure. Those may or may not have even actually happened. And usually it feels a little early to start jumping into these predictions. But as I think we all have realized that these Oscars went on for too long, we are very ready to turn the page into a new slate of movies. And a lot of these are movies we talked about last year because they got pushed back due to the pandemic. So as we usually do, we're going to go back and listen to the predictions we made on last year's version of this episode, which, of course, I believe we recorded it like late February. It was released something like March 8th, like so on the cusp of reality shifting that it's a wild time capsule. So yes, there's a huge grain of salt for much of what we discuss. And there's, you know, some stuff we won't reflect on because, like, you know, we talked about In the Heights and West Side Story a lot, and we'll talk about them again today. But is everybody ready to go back and see how our predictions turned out?
I want to revel in our hubris, you know.
Well, I want to start, as I did last year, with mentioning the movies that we did not mention at all. We actually did a lot better this time because, you know, there wasn't a, like, surprise Toronto film that built buzz. Like, the whole structure of the season worked differently. Like, we did not mention Parasite at all on our Year Ahead episode, but we did mention Nomadland this time. The movies we didn't get into were One Night in Miami, which might be the Toronto surprise I was talking about that built buzz. We didn't talk about Judas and the Black Messiah, although I do think we knew it existed. And we talked about the entire cast of Knives Out deserving Oscars, including Lakeith Stanfield. So it worked out. We didn't talk about Sound of Metal, United States versus Billie Holiday, Soul, the Borat sequel, which nobody knew existed, or Another Round. But other than that, I thought we did pretty well.
The crazy thing about Sound of Metal is it already like fully existed and had like,
I know.
I hadn't seen it, but I could have at that Toronto because I was certainly there. All the other ones, I'm like, well, how could we? They were so far away and whatever. And that one is just like, oh, right. Like that movie full on existed.
Yeah. I don't remember Sound of Metal from that Toronto at all.
I remember seeing it in the lineup and it was one of like two dozen movies that like I wanted to try and see.
Yeah.
I think Kyle Buchanan tweeted about it like Oscar week. He was like, remember when that movie was just the shirtless Riz Ahmed movie from Toronto that a few people saw Toronto and then
It still is in some of our hearts. Sure. It's just the shirtless Riz Ahmed movie. But okay, let's go ahead. Let's start with our clips looking back. And we're going to start with an audio moment that has been referred to many, many times in the subsequent year. So take it away, Brett.
I have currently on my computer monitor, I have a post-it that says January 28th, Richard shoots his shot at Anthony Hopkins winning the Oscar, which is based on an earlier conversation we had this year. I'm keeping it up on my computer until Oscar season. But like, man, Richard, what if you call it 2 years in a row super early? That would be so, I'd be so pleased for you and jealous and burning with envy as well.
So I clipped that just because I know no one has forgotten about the post-it, but I had forgotten that Richard also called Renee Zellweger winning for Judy the year before. So this track record.
We've got a streak happening.
I know.
These are not hard to predict. I mean, again, like I said last week, I walked back the Hopkins prediction months ago. So like, I don't really count that. Zellweger was obvious from Telluride, which I wasn't even at, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Although the weird, yeah. I mean, the Renee Zellweger thing was kind of the opposite, where it was like, it was established, and everyone was like, well, something's going to knock her off the perch, and then nothing ever did. And Anthony Hopkins, you predicted, and then, you know, it seemed like it was over, and then swooped back at the last minute. What yeah. a ride that was.
Not to get too inside baseball, but remember, Katie and Richard, the Toronto 2 years ago when we were sort of sitting in that, like, cantina-esque sort of long table, like, batting back and forth who we thought was going to win the Oscar that year between like Brad Pitt and Renee. And I was firmly on the side of Adam Driver for Marriage Story. Mm. And what fools we all
were. I was convinced of Jennifer Lopez's impending yeah. nomination. And win.
Right. Of course. We were all so excited.
I actually did predict all three of the four winners that year from September, but I was so blinded by Lopez that I didn't see Dern coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, if Jennifer Lopez had just won that Oscar, like maybe she and A-Rod would still be together. Think of how different history could have played out.
As we know, Oscars save marriages.
Just ask Hilary Swank and Chad Black.
And Charlize Theron.
Yeah. Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. Okay, so we, as you might have expected, even though last year, you know, we were sitting there thinking that we would have a year full of movies opening in theaters, we had a pretty healthy Netflix section of our conversation. So let's go back and listen to where we started that Netflix conversation.
You know, you're looking at this list that Joe has compiled. It's incredible how many Netflix movies there are.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's kind of like overwhelming. But the one that sticks out to me just because it has a, you know, kind of strong pedigree is Hillbilly Elegy.
Richard, you also mentioned the idea that maybe Diane Warren would do the theme song in all three of them. Amy Adams, Glenn Close, and Diane Warren could all finally win Oscars. It wasn't meant to be.
She did. I mean, there was a nomination.
I was going to say, yeah, those puzzle pieces got sort of distributed around. And also, and it was for a Netflix movie. So
that's true. The Diane Warren nomination.
Yeah. Katie, I love how you put that in. You just had to like balance out the post-it moment by being like, and here's Richard praising Hillbilly Elegy.
No, I mean, Richard was exactly correct the way that everyone had their eye on Hillbilly Elegy at that time. That was a completely valid prediction to make.
And well, I think the fact that Glenn Close managed to still get a supporting actress nomination, even though that movie was like widely loathed, was, you know, is a testament to exactly what Richard is talking about, which is that like it's got all the elements. And sometimes if even, you know, if you have all the elements like that, you can persevere in a way that, you know, you can hang on by the skin of your teeth to those last couple nominations, which is what Hillbilly Elegy did.
It also helps if you've been bribing the Academy all year. Which I've been doing.
I mean, we thought Glenn Close could swoop in and win that, like, what, until Yoo Jung-yeon won the SAG? Like, she lasted a long time with Oscar
until
buzz.
I wasn't fully ever, like, unprepared for Glenn Close winning, even up until that last second. I was just like, just when we've all dropped our guard is when she's going to win. So, like, I knew that, like, I had to keep at least, like, a thought in my head.
A candle burning.
You never expect a Glenn Close win.
Right.
Like the Spanish Inquisition. Much like that. Exactly. Yeah.
We threw out a couple other Netflix titles, including Mank, but also the Rebecca remake and Boys in the Band, just to float two movies that I had actually forgotten existed until going back and listening to this. And then we get into another one via Joe that I wanted to give special mention if we can play the next clip.
They've got the new Clooney movie, which like... I don't know how excited we should be about George Clooney-directed movies anymore. How many times do we need to sort of get burned by that? But it's called Good Morning, Midnight, and it stars Felicity Jones and David Oyelowo, and it's sort of... Oh, sorry, I'm reading my own description that I copied from IMDb. A scientist alone in the Arctic tries to make contact with a spacecraft returning to Earth, but it's labeled as a drama and not sci-fi, so it feels like it could be sort of... you know, character-based and contemplative and things like that.
Joe, I wanted to include this, not just because Midnight Sky won't be eligible for your podcast this at Oscar Buzz because it did get an Oscar nomination.
Exactly.
But you had it in dead last place in your ranking of the Oscar nominees.
I sure did. The irony, she comes back to bite, doesn't she? Yeah.
Richard and Joanna, did you guys see Midnight Sky?
I reviewed it for VanityFair.com, well, Katie
well,
Rich.
Well, then.
I think I also engaged with both you and Joe, Katie and Joe on Twitter recently I was defending. So Joe, if people don't know, Joe posted his on Vulture a critical ranking of every film nominated for an Oscar from 2020/2021. And yes, like you said, Katie, Midnight Sky was dead last, which I vehemently disagree with. It's a fine movie with a really nice ending and a beautiful score.
I will give you the score. I really did enjoy the score. It was good. I did not click with the actual movie at all. And yet, fool that I am, if not to give a spoiler, but I already have my eye on another George Clooney movie coming up that I'm just like, well, maybe. So I never learn.
Can
ever.
Someone that good looking and charming be a bad director? We're just going to keep trying to find out.
Let's find out. Right. Let's stare at goats and find out. What's interesting about the Midnight Sky campaign is that Clooney, as far as we know, Clooney saw the writing on the wall pretty early and was like, well, people aren't vibing with this. I'm going to just stop pushing it. Do you remember that happening? Like, you know, he did some FYC stuff early on and then he's just sort of like, well, okay.
I'll go back to my Lake Como mansion.
Yeah. Versus, you know, like The Way Back, which is a film that, you know, that Ben Affleck and, you know, the team at Warner Brothers really saw as an opportunity there. And that was chugging for a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, without gripping onto anything. It's just interesting to me when people see the writing on the wall and are like, well, okay. And then when they just sort of keep pushing, because you do never know. Sometimes these late surges can happen. So.
Right.
Well, back on the Netflix beat and back on the This Had Oscar Buzz beat, I think this next one is a movie that you did not even mention in your class of 2020, This Had Oscar Buzz titles, Joe. That's how forgotten it was. So let's go there.
While we're on the subject of Netflix, I wrote about this when I wrote about the sort of like weird movies coming to theaters in 2020, although in this case it's not theaters, it's Netflix, but the Antonio Campos movie, The Devil All the Time, which may not be an awards contender, but like the cast of young talent in this, where it's like Pattinson, Tom Holland, Riley Keough, Eliza Scanlon, Bill Skarsgård, Sebastian Stan, Mia Wasikowska, Hayley Bennett, like it's sort of it's like a Vanity Fair cover come to life.
It's amazing that all those people came out unscathed, I think, is the main thing. Because that movie was just so widely detested, right?
Yeah, it's a terrible movie. And pretty much everyone's bad in it.
And also, like, catch me falling for, like, one of the classic Oscar prediction fallacies that I am powerless to resist, which is, but the cast is so huge and good. And it's just like, how can it miss?
That was your quote on the poster for Crash, right, Joe?
Right, exactly. Look how many people are in this movie.
Brendan Fraser and Matt Dillon.
All right, let's jump to a Netflix prediction that we did a little bit better on.
Netflix is amazing, just in the sheer volume of what they are determined to sort of like bring to us. They're also giving, like, George C. Wolfe is directing Viola Davis and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is one of the August Wilson plays that is now coming to screen. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's a...
And how many awards has Viola Davis won for August Wilson?
Exactly.
You know,
I mean, we did okay on that one. That Ma Rainey won 2 Oscars.
And it was in contention for a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I feel like the hot spots, obviously, at the Oscars, which for like good reason, were Netflix and Sundance. Like, it seemed like early on in that Oscar ceremony, everything that was winning had been a Sundance thing, from like The Father and Promising Young Woman and Minari. And that makes sense because it was, you know, the last time we were able to have an actual film festival.
Yeah.
Before anything happened. And then Netflix was like the bomb shelter where it's just like, it's fine in here. We don't notice anything. Like, business as usual. Like, that sort of makes sense. And then, like, threading the needle through the both of those, which is interesting, is Nomadland, which managed to actually sort of run the gauntlet of the season in this new normal that we had, where they were like virtual film festivals and, you know, trying to take this movie that had, you know, really like big screen appeal when you really think about it because of like the photography of it and whatever.
Yeah.
And still managed to win Best Picture. So like, I think that's kind of interesting story when you think about it that way.
I do wonder if it had a slight leg up, maybe not at all, from the fact that it did actually get a real premiere at a sort of real Venice Film Festival. You know, like there were people there.
Yeah.
Not a ton of I don't think any American journalists went because I don't think they were allowed to go into the country. But I don't think that really mattered. I think what you're more referring to, Joe, correctly, is that like there was a long roadshow for that movie virtually that kept it in conversation well before it came out and then long after it came out.
Yeah.
All right, back to another This Had Oscar Buzz title from last year's episode.
What is the deal with the Sofia Coppola movie and Apple? Because it's, is it going to be a theatrical release or is it going to be Apple Plus exclusive? Do we
know?
Are
they going to try to do like a qualifying thing for it?
Yeah, like
seems
I don't
like
know.
They would have to, right?
Yeah, I think one of the sort of like interesting stories probably this year, but like also going beyond, is like how these other streaming platforms are going to handle trying to, you know, navigate, if they want to navigate the Oscars, how they might try and do that.
So this is interesting, of course, because we didn't know that the entire theatrical distribution was going to get flipped on its head. You know, the Sofia Coppola movie, it is kind of interesting how that movie just like existed for a little while and faded. But I do think like the question of like what Apple is going to be like as a like movie contender is still unanswered after all of this. And I'm curious what happens when these things actually start playing in theaters in theory.
Was Greyhound their only nomination this year?
Wolfwalkers.
The Greyhound Sound domination.
Wolfwalkers.
Oh, right. I always
and
forget
I really,
that they're Wolfwalkers.
I kind of think, even though like Soul dominated so early and so often, I kind of think that if Wolfwalkers had the big splashy theatrical release that Apple was supposed to give, like the first Cartoon Saloon film to get like the push of an Apple behind them, I do think it would have been a close, like they had a real good shot, I think. There was a lot of love for that film. I think if more people had seen it, it would have had a better chance. So,
and obviously Justin Timberlake won for Palmer.
Correct.
Yes.
So,
correct. Yeah. Oh, don't forget Cherry.
Best
I
picture.
Another This Had Oscar Buzz Hall of Famer.
I really thought that was going to get nominated for something. I really did. I was very prepared.
Well,
for
like
that.
Cherry's right there with like the Mauritanian, and I feel like there's like one other like late breaking February, or like Malcolm and Marie, maybe, of all these movies. They're like, we're going to throw it out there late, and it's going to be on everyone's minds, and like they none of it worked really. Yep. Like The Father, I think, is the only one that like kind of used that strategy and it worked, and it had been
Sony
playing
Pictures,
for over a year.
Sony Pictures Classics usually does know how to do that well, you know.
Yeah if the Oscars and the 2017 Oscars had been in April, Call Me by Your Name might have actually pulled out better results, because it might have actually played in theaters for people by then. So with that long delayed release strategy of theirs.
Yeah, they know how to play that long game. Although Truffle Hunters still RIP to its Oscar chances. But it's, I think it's still yet to be playing in theaters, but I hope people go see it. All right, back to Netflix, I think for the last time, for the last big Netflix one.
We haven't talked about the Aaron Sorkin film yet, right?
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, totally.
So the Trial of Chicago 7, which is coming out in late September, so sort of prime spot. This is,
TIFF,
you know,
premiere?
The,
can we bet on a TIFF premiere?
Seems like it, right? One of those TIFF, like, oh, the movie is opening in like a week. Should I see it now or should I?
Right.
Should like excellent Oscar precursor, The Goldfinch.
Right, exactly.
Based on, in an election year, based on, you know, right before the election, based on true story around, you know, the uprising at the 1968 DNC convention in Chicago. And the cast is Eddie Redmayne, Jessica Gordon-Levitt, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who was great in Watchmen, Mark Rylance, and Jeremy Strong. So, like, a really good cast. You know, Aaron Sorkin, I have some pre-fatigue around that, but... but that just seems like something we can't ignore. I'm gonna shout out myself for just skipping Sacha Baron Cohen in the list of that cast.
The only Oscar nominee from that cast in the end.
Well, as Katie said about our Borat omission, no one knew that Sacha Baron Cohen existed in February of last year.
Just Isla Fisher. She was the only one who knew.
His biggest fan. I mean, what happens later in this that I didn't clip is that Joe talks about this movie potentially coming out after a brokered Democratic convention and how raw our feelings might have been from that, which to me was just such a fascinating glimpse into late February 2020.
Well, I was going to say, what a February 2020 moment.
I know, because like,
clearly,
you know,
me with the finger on the pulse, knowing that like the political unrest would definitely come from the Democrats this year.
It really, like, this was like the clearest one listening back to where I was just like, we had no clue what was coming for us. This wasn't even a Netflix movie then. It was supposed to come out from Paramount. And so it got sold to Netflix after the pandemic started. And so much of just like us trying to look ahead and being like, well, the election's going to be the biggest story of the year. So how are we all going to feel? And like, I don't know how you guys feel about it. To me, the election didn't play a huge role in how this Oscar season played out. I think if Trump had won, it would have.
Yes.
But it was everything else was so topsy-turvy.
I think if Trump had won and if the Oscars had been closer to, you know, the inauguration than they were.
Yeah.
And if there hadn't been a global pandemic.
Right. Well, I think also you look at like what was the current events tie in to Chicago 7 when it actually did open. It wasn't election stuff. It was Black Lives Matter protests anti-police protests. And that was the sort of tie in when people sort of discussed that movie in a larger context. And so, yeah, everything that we sort of expected kind of got turned on its head and in multiple ways. But I think a good instinct by Joanna to look at that movie and be like, this has sort of, this is red meat for the Oscar voters. And it turned out to be such, even if it didn't win anything.
Thank you, Joe.
Sure.
It's posted on my monitor, but I'll take it.
Should we call this yearly episode the Trial of the Little Gold Men 4?
Yes, exactly.
Where I play the clips and make you guys atone.
And then there were four because Hogan's no longer here to answer for predicting Ready Player One or anything like that.
Yeah, well, so. Mike was on half of last year's episode before he had to duck out. He did say, I predict that the Best Picture winner is not on this list, which was not right because Nomadland was on there, but truly none of us thought Nomadland was going to win either. So
no, absolutely not.
Joe, we did a little bit of Chicago 7 kind of postmorteming last week on our post-Oscars episode. You know, it got a ton of nominations, didn't win anything. Do you have any hot takes on why it like seemed tailor-made for the Oscars and couldn't win a single thing?
I mean, that tends to have been the Netflix narrative over these last few years, right? That was the thing with, I mean, Roma won some awards, but obviously didn't win Best Picture. The Irishman had, I believe, 10 nominations and didn't win any of them, I think, is how that went down. And even like, you know, Chicago 7 and also like Mank won a couple awards and happily so because I loved Mank, but didn't win anything major. And that feels like that's going to be the next Netflix awards narrative is, you know, can they win the big one? Now they're whatever the Boston Red Sox Oscar gaming or whatever. It's just like they, you know, can they get over the hump?
And I just refuse to think of Netflix as an underdog, though. Like, I just can't.
Well, that's the thing. It's hard to do that. And I think that's why they're going to have, you know, a problem with harnessing something like that. But it also feels like that's definitely going to be, feels like more and more the sort of schadenfreude of, you know, haha, Netflix. Becomes more and more intense. But I also feel like that could change the way that they end up campaigning. Because the last few years, they've campaigned very broadly. They've put out several, you know, potential nominees and multiple Best Picture contenders in the last few years. They've had multiple Best Picture nominees at least the last 2 years. Maybe that changes for them. Maybe they decide we need to focus in on just one movie and like literally like just push out everything once we decide what our front runner is and really go hard for that. I don't know. I'm not in, you know, those discussions.
Right. The Warner Brothers approach this year. Like, I think that will be interesting to look at. And like, you know, we're going to talk about it, about the Netflix offerings this year, but I don't see, or maybe I'm just missing the like Mank or Roma of this year or Irishman of this year, but maybe you guys can spot it. I'm just not seeing it.
I was just thinking about the fact that Netflix has yet to win Best Picture or the Best Drama Series Emmy, which I think is, you know, what some people consider like the big brass ring. And for a second, I was like, no, they had to have won for The Crown, and they didn't. It was Game of Thrones a bunch of years, and then Succession.
Yeah.
This might be the year for The Crown, but that the fact that...
Meanwhile, Hulu keeps winning. Hulu wins for Handmaid's Tale.
Hulu wins for Nomadland.
Yeah.
I know. Man, the fact that Hulu won for Handmaid's Tale feels wilder and wilder as the years go on.
Disney's the Handmaid's Tale.
let's get off of Netflix and onto a different Hollywood powerhouse. Well, it makes me think that we should keep an eye on Universal since they had Green Book and 1917 back to back. But they do have a Paul Greengrass, Tom Hanks movie slated for Christmas.
They do.
A Western about a man bringing the news to townspeople. I don't know. Westerns are an interesting prospect with Oscar. News of the World did get nominated for...
News of the World's earliest fan, Katie Rich.
I know. You know. Oh, God, that's so predictable for me to be like a Tom Hanks Western. It is weird to me that, like, it didn't go further than it did, you know? Yeah. Like, as a... Because, like, obviously, as we were just talking about, like, the whole, like, streaming-only thing is still weird for the Oscars. Like, they like something to be a little bit more of a traditional studio movie. I didn't love News of the World, but I did... I kind of thought it would get more traction.
I feel like more people would have seen it if it had been in theaters.
Yes.
I think a Tom Hanks movie like that, people would have gone to the theaters, and then people would have been talking about it.
Didn't they kind of put it in theaters, though?
I think
around
so.
Christmas?
I think it and Promising Young Woman, because that was, you know, Focus, which is also Universal, were both in theaters around the same time, but I'm not sure.
I think what really I meant briefly. Is, like, people who were, when people are going to, I mean, you know, even though films were in theaters, people aren't going. But, like, I could see that the Tom Hanks film, I think I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but, you know, my family for years had a traditional, like, let's go see a movie the day after Christmas thing, and I could definitely see News of the World being something we would pick to go see.
Yes, you know? Except Christmas was, like, the height of the pandemic.
No, exactly.
Terrible
but
idea.
Other years.
So I just want to just really quick about that. So it was theatrically released on Christmas Day, and then there was a premium VOD that started mid-January. So it was really expensive. There was a 2-week gap from when it was out in theaters, and I think it just really got lost in that. People didn't know where to watch it or how to watch it, and then by the time it was available to them, you know, at not a crazy price, they'd forgotten about it.
Well, and especially this Christmas, where if you had, depending on the platforms that you subscribe to, you could watch Wonder Woman 1984 for free, you could watch Soul for free, you could, you know, all these other things. And so premium VOD for, you know, the Tom Hanks dad Western, which, you know, appeals to some people certainly, but like, I think that was maybe when we were starting to see the limits of premium VOD for even entertainment, you know, starved people. There were other options and there are better options. And maybe you want to wait out until it's $3 to rent News of the World instead of $20.
I think those premium VOD films were more successful, as you say, Joe, if they were a film that you could gather the whole family is going to sit down and watch. And so you feel like you're getting the bang for your buck. And News of the World, I think, might be a tougher sit, you know, for a lot of people. So
not just Katie sitting alone in her cigar room in her house.
Love it.
Not the cigar room.
I definitely watched News of the World like hunched over my laptop, which was a really bummer of a way to watch it.
I watched it on my TV for some reason. I don't know why. It was great.
Smarter. I picked this one as a someone we will talk about for this year's lineup, but just as a reminder of what the future we thought was going to look like in March of last year.
What do we think of Ana de Armas in Blonde?
Well, we have to support that. She's our cover girl.
Vanity Fair cover star, Ana de Armas.
Yeah, she's, you know, playing Marilyn Monroe, doing a lot of voice work, trying to get the thing right.
It was supposed to be Ana de Armas' year, you guys. She's waited patiently a year for this whole breakout thing and, like, has done it well.
She was drafting off of Knives Out, had the Ben Affleck movie, Blonde and Bond. Blonde and Bond. And Ben. Ben, Bond, and Blonde.
Oprah.
Yeah. But the funny thing is that obviously a lot happened in her personal life, or at least the paparazzi captured version of her personal life. But all of those movies now have just shifted to this year. But she's lost a little of the Knives Out momentum, but she's maintained it with Ana de Armas updates, you know, like Zoom lens of her and Ben Affleck, and then her and Ben Affleck breaking up.
Well, I know I was going through this lovely spreadsheet that Joe made for us of everything, and I was like, oh, the Ana de Armas year is coming. Like, I got really excited for her again. So I don't know.
Well, but it's interesting to, as I think, as Richard said, like a year out, like how much of the air has been let out of the balloon. Not to keep bringing up things I've written for other outlets, but when I did the Vulture thing, the speculative history of what 2020 at the movies might have been without a pandemic, my vision was sort of just like, oh, it would have been like the Ana de Armas Ben Affleck tiff, because like mm-hmm. it's very plausible she could have been there with both Blonde and the Adrian Lyne movie that they both did together, Deep Water. And I was like, there's a very real possibility that they could have just sort of like been like the paparazzi darlings or whatever and gotten just like a lot of heat off of that in general. And yeah. that's not going to happen the same way this year if it happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if were I more of a conspiracy theorist, I would lay out like how that relationship with her and Ben Affleck and their Duncan runs has played perfectly into her maintaining this momentum. But you know what? I hope she's happy. And I am rooting for her having a big year as well. All right. Now we get into, a prediction I made that came decently true. So I'm going to brag about it. Let's play the clip. I made another meta list of female directors because, as I was mentioning with Little Women, like we didn't really talk about that as a topic. But I do think this year the attention is going to be incredibly high on female directors and trying to get someone in there. So just going through the list from what we have, Emerald Fennell's Promising Young Woman from Sundance. We talked about that. Chloe Zhao has two movies. She has Nomadland with Frances McDormand with Fox Searchlight and then also Eternals. The movie that I'm maybe most excited to see on this entire list is Clea DuVall's Happiest Season.
I was going
to
say, yeah. I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Guys, what if Clea DuVall had also been a Best Director nominee? I would have been so smart.
I can't believe you didn't know how to pronounce Emerald Fennell's last name. What a lot of egg on your face for
that whole
entire
segment. I didn't know how to pronounce
that
until like a month ago. Like, I really dragged my feet on that one.
No, that's incredibly, like, that's a great feather in your cap.
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
I
like,
can't believe. We were like, Joe, you said you would write in First Cow. And we were like, ha, 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 no Oscar buzz for First Cow. But it hung in there longer than we expected last March.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We also mentioned a Mian Hansen Love movie, which I don't believe came out. A Lisa Joy sci-fi movie, which I don't believe has come out. And then also Gina Prince-Bythewood's The Old Guard, which was like my summer delight. So it was a good year for female directors. I'm glad it happened.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
All right, back to the This Had Oscar Buzz section of the flashback.
This past year, like, winners who hadn't won in a long time or who had never won finally getting their award. Also in that kind of category would be Saoirse Ronan, who's been nominated 4 times at the age of, like, 25 or something. Didn't get it for Little Women, but has this movie called Ammonite with Kate Winslet, who has not won in about 12 years, directed by Frances Lee, who did God's Own Country.
What happened with Ammonite, guys? Was it just biding its time so the Mayor of Easttown train could roll on unimpeded?
Yeah, I think Ammonite just, well, from a certain subset of maybe film journalists came burdened with a lot of expectation, and then it didn't meet those expectations, and in fact was something, I mean, actually close to what Frances Lee has made previous, but it didn't feel like the expansion, the sort of bigger, glossier, Oscar-y movie that maybe it seemed poised to be.
Yeah, with the stars that it had.
Yeah. I know that some people, I think our own Cassie DaCosta has written about it favorably. I kind of gave it a pretty like negative-ish review, but I think it's found its audience. It's found its fans, certainly, Ammonite, but yeah. A lot of people were like, it's too slow, it's too cold, it's too remote.
I feel like I saw by the end of the year a lot of people being like, wow, we really slept on this Kate Winslet performance this year. And so at the very least, I think maybe, I don't know, maybe it helps contribute to the Kate Winslet Emmy campaign for this year or something. Who knows?
So I'm sure Frances Lee is thrilled by.
Yeah. But I think it was also one of those things where, and this happens even in non-pandemic years, where something premieres at Toronto and the very earliest reviews are just like, it's a miss, you guys. And then everybody's like, well, I can move on to the next thing. And that's sort of how it felt like with the buzz for Ammonite.
It's just funny to me that in a year when so much of the stuff we talked about got delayed, there were still titles that could come and go in an instant that not get Oscar buzz at all. Like, we thought we had a limited selection, but it happened.
Right. Even in this year when you would think like everybody's going to be lapping up every possible thing. But like, that's the sort of paradox of the pandemic year, right? It's just like, there were still a shit ton of movies.
Yeah.
They were just, you know, not available in the normal sense.
All right, we're almost rounding the end of our flashback. We'll get to our best picture predictions in a second. But we talked about The Humans, which we might get into again, the adaptation of the Broadway play, which Steven Yeun, I had forgotten, will be in when it does finally come out. But that led into this next part of the conversation.
It could solidify Steven Yeun's chances for Minari, which is the movie that won the jury prize at Sundance and is incredible. And Steven Yeun is amazing as this, you know, Korean immigrant father trying to make a better life for his family in rural Arkansas.
Yeah.
So like maybe he could have like a very good year with that kind of dual thing, like where I kind of think that Ad Astra being just good enough helped Brad Pitt get the Oscar for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure I get my voice on this Yeun sound clip if it happens to come up next year. I want to agree with Richard. The Yeun momentum is here.
Congratulations, Joanna.
Thank you. When he started playing it, I was like, Joanna Robinson of the past, if you don't say something right now about how much you love Steven Yeun, you're going to be mad. And so thanks, me.
You were on the record. It does feel nice that, you know, Minari was something we were rooting for. Minari and Promising Young Woman, really, both from Sundance. We're like, wow, these are great movies that are fascinating. Everyone wants to talk about it. I wonder how they'll hang on through the year. And then they really, really did. Okay, so as we start to wrap up our flashback, we can get into our bold year-ahead Best Picture predictions. Joe, you picked Mank. You compared it potentially to The Irishman as being a long and slow Netflix movie that would get nominated for Best Picture. And
who could have anticipated? who knew I would be so right?
Yeah. But it did win two Oscars, so you can take that credit. Joanna, you picked Trial of Chicago 7. You just kind of said, I'll go ahead with the Sorkin. And I mean, even though it didn't win anything, I still think that was a good prediction. Do you stand by it?
Sure. It's a safe bet. Yeah.
I mean, okay, I picked Those Who Wish Me Dead, which is the Angelina Jolie fire western coming out like in a month or so now.
In a week. It's like very soon.
I will give myself credit that I said I don't think a Netflix movie is going to win, kind of trying to take the lessons from The Irishman. So I picked it as a studio movie from Warner Brothers. Obviously, we didn't see coming what Warner Brothers is doing now and putting all their stuff on streaming and in theaters. But, you know, I was right on some level that it wasn't going to be a Netflix movie. And then I'm going to close out the flashback with Richard's prediction, which I think should send us nicely into talking about 2022. So go ahead.
It's been 6 years since Wes Anderson got a bunch of Oscar nominations for the Grand Budapest Hotel. His new one, The French Dispatch, is star-studded. I think it's more than likely going to premiere at Cannes. Yes, it comes out in the summer, which means it has a long runway. But Grand Budapest came out even earlier. That came out in March. And I don't know, I just think that this could be the year to see a bunch of journalists working abroad, making everyone feel good.
Richard, do you just want to say that again verbatim for this year? Because I still feel like all of it holds true, just delayed a year.
It could. I mean, you know, I think one thing standing in the way, I mean, I haven't seen The French Dispatch. Again, it is slated, I think, to be at Cannes this year, is that Wes Anderson makes one could say almost stridently apolitical films. And I don't necessarily know what the appetite for that's going to be as the Oscars kind of tries to, in some senses, rebrand its awards. But yeah, I mean, I think it could be a contender. Again, you know, going by the Reed rubric, there's a lot of people in that movie.
Yes, the number one consideration for whether something is going to be an Oscar contender. Yeah.
I was thinking, though, what you said about it being apolitical. I was thinking about the Grand Budapest Hotel and how it has this, like, aching nostalgia for this period before everything got turned upside down, which is a lot of the way I think about, you know, the spring of 2020 or, you know, the January 2020. And I wonder if there'll be something of that, like this feeling that we all have of like we've emerged from the rubble of something, something that's got that kind of nostalgia for an old world that we've left behind. I wonder if it might feel more, if not political, timely because of what's happened.
Yeah.
Well, and his movies, too, tend to, it's not even just that it's like nostalgia for an old time. It's like, it's a world that exists outside of our world. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? It's just like, it's something completely sort of unto itself. And that's a kind of escapism that, like, even as we sort of all venture outside of our little worlds that we've built for ourselves, like, we can, you know, look at something like that and just be like, oh, I don't have to watch this movie and think about, you know, X, Y, and Z terrible things sort of bearing down the road at us. And I also feel like, as Richard mentioned in the clip, the fact that Wes Anderson sort of got over the hump with the Grand Budapest Hotel, and we've seen that with a lot of the sort of 21st century young talented directors, your David Finchers and Alexander Payne's and that kind
or
of
Aronofsky,
thing.
Or Aronofsky, David O. Russell.
Right.
Yeah.
Once they get over that hump, then the Oscars sort of, they're in the club a little bit. And then at the very least, their movies get consideration and they don't have to sort of fight to stand, you know, for their own standing a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think, and especially, you know, with Best Picture still being, you know, this, you know, longer list, and there's, you know, if there's 9 slots to fill up, then your very respected auteur filmmakers like this stand a pretty good shot.
Yeah. And I think we're going to talk about this a lot as we look ahead to the year. But the idea of like a big, expensive production with a bunch of people all in the same room together and crowds and all this kind of stuff that now feels exotic, I think there's going to be a ton of appeal in that. And French Dispatch seems like it's one of several titles that could provide it.
I want to open a door that's only going to cause me pain because I think all of you on this call have already seen it except for me. But That sort of nostalgia for not the before times of like in the Wes Andersonian way, but in the like, oh, this is a delayed present we were supposed to get in 2020 and now we get it in 2021 is how I feel undeniably about In the Heights. It's like my most anticipated, it was my most anticipated film last year and it is again this year. And like I said, I know maybe all of you have seen it already, but
I haven't.
Okay, Jill,
I
have not seen
it. I'm seeing it this week.
Okay, great. Joe, you and I in solidarity of our anticipation, but I don't know. It's coming, it's opening soonish. So I don't know if that's going to like bring it forward through the whole year. I also know, of course, West Side Story is coming and some people feel like they tread on similar ground, but I feel like we should have a big slashy musical win this year.
I mean, they do tread on similar ground. Like, they are both movies filmed in the streets of real New York that are musicals.
That's what I said.
Like,
they tread on similar ground.
It made it sound like you thought that they had more distance between them than we
No.
They're very different, obviously.
But I feel like, I think that doesn't necessarily have to be a negative, because I think there's a chance that this becomes the narrative. And if the narrative is West Side Story versus In the Heights, then at the very least, you know, the best case scenario of that is, well, they both get nominated for Best Picture and they're both sort of main contenders as we move through the year. And I think I've long thought that that comparison, and again, sight unseen, I haven't seen either one of these movies, but that comparison would probably tend to favor In the Heights because it is newer.
Mm-hmm.
It is from a more up-and-coming filmmakers, so, like, that's an exciting narrative. And it doesn't star Ansel Elgort, so, like, that's an advantage at this point.
It does star Jimmy Smits, always an advantage.
But I feel like a Spielberg movie that's a big musical remake of a Best Picture winner is going to be a contender no matter what. But I think the fact that those two movies are going to be spoken of in the same breath all year, because In the Heights opens in the summer and West Side Story opens in December. Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to end up being a benefit, I think, to both of those movies.
Can I open the door to further pain, Joanna? If you remember that Rocket Man came out in the spring and Bohemian Rhapsody came out around Christmas or Thanksgiving or whatever it was, and which one was better and which one won awards. You know, like, I just feel like
that is painful to remember.
That was just like, that's like, That's like Bernardo jamming a dagger in a riff, man. Why would you do it?
I'm not saying necessarily that In the Heights will be better than West Side Story. I don't know anyone who has seen West Side Story. I do know people who've seen In the Heights. But yeah, I mean, like, I think that the spring release, this, or, you know,
I think it's summer-ish, mid-June.
Yeah, release is, could be a detriment to In the Heights, even though it makes total sense because it's a big outdoor dancing in the streets, summery kind of movie. I think it fits really well in that time slot, especially as we're all, well, it, you know, vaccinated and, you know, at least running out into the streets this summer ourselves.
Yeah, I think
I should say, in the interests of full transparency, I have seen West Side Story in the sense that I saw them filming it outside my window of my apartment for about three consecutive weekends as they were filming the America scene, among other things. So I am the first look exclusive.
I had been feeling kind of skeptical about West Side Stories. I think a lot of people had being like, why would you remake a perfect movie? Like, is Spielberg the person you want to do this? And then I think maybe all of us saw the trailer that aired during the Oscars and were like, oh, God, but it's West Side Story. I'm just going to cry on sense memory of hearing the whistle from the beginning of the movie.
It looks really, like, the look of it is really intriguing.
Yeah.
It looks better to me than a lot of recent Spielberg because it is not very, like, CGI heavy as far as I've seen so far.
Ready Player One.
And, but that trailer also did hide Ansel Elgort. The thing, In the Heights thing that I want to say, I guess, is that, oh yeah, this is what I want to say. One of our listeners, and I can't remember if it was via subtext or on Twitter or something like that, suggested that next year's Oscars open with a dance-off between the West Side Story cast and the In the Heights cast. And I was like, yes, please. Bring it from the streets into the theater. I want it, you know?
If next year's Oscars are going to be a response to this year's Oscars in terms of just like, you want entertainment, you want fun, like that's the way to do it. Yeah. Like that's what you do.
Opens with dance-off. And then as the two warring dancer tribes of dancers part, House of Gucci nominee Lady Gaga walks center stage singing a song.
Perfect. You want Twitter memes? We'll give you Twitter memes.
Right, exactly.
Well, then, yeah, let's talk about House of Gucci and other movies that maybe we didn't talk about this time last year. Joe, as the keeper of the list, I feel like you probably have the best overall sense of, like, what is coming. Do you sense any themes, any particular, like, you know, trends to watch out for and what's coming
this year? The keeper of the list is a moniker I'm definitely going to hold on to.
And
thank
what,
you
the
for
read
that.
Rubric? We got all kinds of
I feel
of
like I'm Sigourney Weaver at the end of Ghostbusters or something like that. I'm the keeper of the list. I think two Ridley Scott movies with big sort of high profile casts, those are interesting. Although Ridley Scott being a multiple time Oscar nominee and obviously Gladiator has won Best Picture, we also tend to forget that, like, he misses kind of as often as he hits these days.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I don't know. I'm still, there's a part of me that's just sort of like, Adam Driver, Lady Gaga, Al Pacino, I'm so in. It's about Gucci. It's about fashion. It's about murder. I'm in. And then I'm like, Ridley Scott, though. And it's just like, I don't know. So
I mean, that photo of Lady Gaga and Adam Driver, like, you know, their Christmas card photo was like the most exciting. It's like the only movie news anyone has cared about in months.
Right.
At least in our corner of the world.
Right, exactly. So, like, yeah, in terms of, like, if you're looking for a narrative, there's those two movies. His other movie is the Last Duel, the one that we're all, I think, decidedly less excited about. But, like, there's possibilities there. That's a script by, at least a version of that script was written by Nicole Holofcener, I'm pretty sure. And I'm not sure whether was one that had gotten reworked or not, but, like, I don't want to sort of speak out of turn. But anyway,
I just feel like it's so predictable that Ridley Scott in 2021 would have a movie written by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and Nicole Holofcener coming out. I mean, isn't that just like such an obvious?
Yeah, just like so typical. It's so typical.
It is interesting that his two movies, like the Duel one, like that is like Kingdom of Heaven, Gladiator, Ridley Scott, and then House of Gucci is this kind of newly emerging Ridley Scott, like from All the Money in the World, where it's like wealthy crime scandal family kind of thing. And both are going to be competing within, you know, very close proximity to each other in the fall. I feel like it could, you know, if the movies are both good, they could still kind of almost split the vote somehow.
It makes me wonder if one of them will move, which I guess would be House of Gucci because The Last Duel was shot forever ago. And I remain curious about where this Ben Affleck narrative is going to take us. Like, Ben Affleck is getting more attention now than he has in, like, 20 years, maybe, for hanging out with J-Lo and, you know, his year of Walks with Ana de Armas. So, like, he's got Deepwater coming. He's got The Last Duel coming. Like, I don't know.
So here's where I make my Ben Affleck prediction.
Okay.
Though.
Okay. Do it.
And I talked about how, you know, I am a Charlie Brown and the football is George Clooney directed movies. But his next movie is something called The Tender Bar, which is a coming of age movie about a kid who goes to, I believe, like, either goes to live with his uncle or, like, sort of, like, grows up under the tutelage of his uncle who owns a bar and sort of the patrons at the bar. That uncle is going to be played by Ben Affleck. So, like, Long Island working class dad Fleck sort of vibe happening, like, in a Clooney movie, which, like, definitely gives me pause, but, and this is an Amazon movie, so, like, it also gives me, like, Manchester by the Sea vibes a little bit, and, like, we know what that has done for an Affleck before, and I'm not, it doesn't seem like it's going to be that kind of a heavy drama, but, like, a supporting actor campaign for Ben Affleck, where he's playing, like, the, you know, the uncle who helps raise this, like, coming-of-age kid, that's an Oscar campaign I could see someone working with, you know what I mean?
The memoir it's based on was very well received when it came out.
Yeah.
And it's William Monahan doing the screenplay. So maybe that can kind of help combat some of Clooney's worst directorial impulses.
Well, and if Clooney is, like, the thing about Clooney oftentimes is that, like, he's, like, his stuff to me seems dull. Like, that's sort of what I feel like watching a lot of these movies. It's just like, I just feel like, why is this, you know, so dull? You have all these, like, you know, these elements that could work. And I think a spotlight supporting campaign where, like, even if there are flaws in the movie, you could just be like, okay, but, like, Affleck is so good. Or the people who, like, because I think there's a lot of goodwill for Ben Affleck. I don't always get it, but, like, it's there. So I think that's a possibility.
Yeah, you can definitely see the Way Back campaign, which didn't ultimately take off as, you know, paving the way for the comeback, which we see happen a lot of times where someone doesn't get the nomination 1 year and then comes in for the next year.
Yeah. Another narrative, if you're looking for it, is Denzel Washington, who is in the Joel Coen directed The Tragedy of Macbeth opposite brand new three-time Oscar winner Frances McDormand. Denzel is playing Macbeth. And then he's also directing.
So exciting.
Oh, I'm so excited for that. I'm so excited for that. But then he's also got a movie he's directing coming out with Michael B. Jordan that is seems like it's possibly, you know, pretty sentimental. It's about a soldier overseas and sort of writing a letter back to his son. And Michael B. Jordan, somebody who we've long thought was on the cusp of getting his first Oscar nomination. So, like, that one also feels like there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, the idea of Denzel Washington and Michael B. Jordan, like, you know, even though Denzel Washington has an actual son who is a movie star in his own right, like, that feels like a real handing of the baton from one generation to the next.
Very possibly. Yeah.
All right. Who else wants to hop on something they're excited about?
I don't know how Oscar-y it is, given how genre it might be, but Guillermo del Toro has Nightmare Alley, which I think is still filming or just finished filming. What?
I'm so sorry. I just have to laugh because Joe's description here begins with the three words, an ambitious carny. And I have texted that to Joe twice in the last 24 hours. Just
pulled
that
directly
phrase.
From IMDb. I cannot take credit for
just
that.
Just that phrase, yes. An ambitious carny. Please go ahead. I'm carny. So excited.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really interesting. And, like, I think this is Del Toro's first film since Shape of Water, right?
Yes.
So that's a kind of Oscar-y follow-up. Maybe now, like you guys mentioned, he's in the club.
Oh, yeah,
and,
for sure.
You know, it's Bradley Cooper, Cate Blanchett, Willem Dafoe, Toni Collette, Richard Jenkins, Ron Perlman, Rooney Mara, David Strathairn. Again, everyone's in it. That's, you know, but, you know, that could also be more drama thriller, or, like, you know, maybe the thriller side of it is more, you know, heavily leaned on, that it wouldn't make it like a best picture front runner, but, like, its pedigree is certainly undeniable. And it's one that there were photos released from the shoot, like, before quarantine.
Yeah, it filmed in Buffalo. It filmed a lot of scenes, at least, in Buffalo. So that was, it's been on my radar for that, too.
Yeah, and people got really excited about those photos. So it kind of already has at least a small kernel of awareness that might kind of make it stick out.
Yeah, I want to flag a couple things. Obviously, the dual fanning power
of Melanie Laurent's The Nightingale, which stars Dakota Fanning and Elle Fanning and Tom Sturridge. So that, and that one's coming out right around Christmas. So obviously they're positioning that for something. And then I'm interested in this Kenneth Branagh film, Belfast.
Me too. I had that. That's definitely one I have my eye on.
Yeah, this is Judi Dench, Katrina Balfe, Jamie Dornan, and Kieran Hines. And I don't know. It's a possibility. Like, Kenneth Branagh, you know, started out like such a beloved darling of bringing Shakespeare to film and stuff like that, and then got kind of far away from it with a lot of these, like, you know, a few of these CG spectacles and stuff like that. But I think that this film, which, you know, might have the possibility of bringing it closer to his own childhood. This is like a, you know, a young boy in his working class family experience in the tumultuous late 1960s, and you know, an Irish film, Kenneth Branagh, an Irish actor. Like, I think this is, could be like a return to form for him. That would be really exciting for me personally.
Yeah. Wait, is his next Poirot movie coming out? It got rescheduled to early 2022.
Starring Armie Hammer.
Starring Armie Hammer. I know.
Right.
It's going to be a whole thing. Yeah. So it will be out of the way of the Oscar buzz for this if it works out, basically.
Right. Yes. Right. Yes, it will be. Yeah.
Speaking of the British Isles, or the, you know, I'm going to get geography wrong. Anyway, in the 60s, Edgar Wright's movie Last Night in Soho seems really intriguing to me, just in general. Like, an Oscar, it seems like a big question mark as Oscar, but I'm trying to look through this list and find big movies, because as I was saying earlier, like, I think spectacle and size and energy are going to be really appealing. And the brief description of it, you know, I think it's somewhat mysterious, but the idea of someone like time traveling to this idealized time period and finding out it's not all that it adds up to be. It's Anya Taylor-Joy, who, you know, is a gigantic star at the moment. She was just our cover star, so maybe she's the Ana de Armas of 2021, or like what we thought was going to be, where she's going to be everywhere. And she's in it with Thomasin McKenzie, who is also a huge up-and-comer. I don't know. Like, I wonder if the right combination could make, you know, Edgar Wright an Oscar contender finally.
I would love that for him. It feels like Edgar Wright should have a screenwriting Oscar, right? Like, at the very least.
Yeah.
There's a PTA movie this year, obviously. Soggy Bottom, Bradley Cooper, Benny Safdie, 1970 San Fernando Valley, that I'm kind of excited about. Also, Michael Showalter's The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yeah.
With Jessica Chastain, Andrew Garfield as Jim Baker. And I, like, I had to run. As soon as I saw it, I ran to Google to see if there were images of Andrew Garfield as Jim Baker, but none that I could find yet. So I cannot wait for that wig reveal. I'm very excited.
There are images of Chastain, though, I believe.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, when those were released, people were like,
I mean, it's a big look, though. You know, like, Tammy Faye Baker was a wild looking person. So, I mean, and like, and Jessica Chastain's kind of like big energy might be really well suited there.
And to go back to the PTA, Soggy Bottom, I think he is another person kind of like Wes Anderson, who, like, has been producing really interesting work since the late 90s or mid 90s and has not quite hit, you know, gotten the, he hasn't won an Oscar yet. So a movie of his coming out, like, has a nostalgia factor, because it's like, yeah, he's like one of like the young auteurs now who's like entering this interesting mid career. And I don't know, this movie is about a child actor in LA in the 70s. And I think that after the sort of nostalgia for that era that worked so well for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I'm just kind of curious if, like, that's another narrative where it's like, is this Paul Thomas Anderson's year? And like, that movie just got moved to Thanksgiving, which might mean that it's not going to be like at Cannes, but I could see it like being big at Venice. PTA has won
Festival centerpiece.
Right.
Yeah. Like, PTA has won Best Director at Venice, Berlin, and Cannes. He's like one of the only directors to have done that. So I feel like this could be a thing, unless it's some tiny little personal project or something that doesn't have the sweep that the Academy's looking for.
But if you look at Paul Thomas Anderson's career, especially as of late, he's so incredibly respected by Oscar voters, where, like, even when he makes a movie that people don't really latch onto, or that they're sort of like cold to, like, Inherent Vice got a screenplay nomination. The Master got several nominations, even though most people were just like, I don't know about The Master. Like, it was well respected, but there wasn't a love for it. And then I think when you saw something like Phantom Thread, that had a little bit of like a slow burn, but like, eventually people really did seem to really love that movie. And I feel like if that's the arc that Paul Thomas Anderson is on, I think a small personal movie could end up doing well, sort of like how Alfonso Cuarón doing something, you know, small and personal with Roma, ends up, you know, can tend to be a good narrative for a director who's so respected for sort of, you know, mastery of his craft. Kind
especially
of a thing.
As Phantom Thread demonstrated in its unique way, as did Inherent Vice a little bit, if Anderson in his maturity, father of four children, like, is maybe getting a little bit more, a little softer, a little more sentimental. I think, you know, There Will Be Blood in mm-hmm. The Master and There Will Be Blood, you know, did win a big Oscar for Daniel Day-Lewis. But like, those are really technical, subsuming, kind of yes. cold movies. I mean, really interesting, but like difficult to sort of yeah. sit with. Whereas, so if there's a sweetness to this story of a child actor in 1970s LA, that could really even further ingratiate it to the Academy.
Yeah.
I would be remiss if I didn't shout out my really good friend's sister, Liesl Tommy, who's directing Respect, which is the Aretha Franklin biopic with Jennifer Hudson. I don't know. He's seen a cut and he really loved it, but also that's his sister. So I don't know that I can say that is unbiased, but she's an incredible theater director. I've seen some of her productions and they're amazing. And so I'm excited to see her make this jump. I don't know what this is going to be. I'm sure there will at least be, you know, an over the credit song nomination for that Jennifer Hudson can sing at the ceremony. But like, what have you guys heard about this film?
I mean, honestly, the fact that the Cynthia Erivo Aretha Franklin TV movie, not a series, right? The
Genius
one.
Yeah, yeah.
I just like, they are colliding in my head constantly, which is not really fair to either of them. But, and I think as we get closer to Respect, it will be able to stand on its own as a movie more. But, you know, as Andre Day just proved, like the power of a really famous person biopic is you can't dismiss it.
Give me the Audra McDonald supporting actress nomination.
Absolutely. Oh, now right? You have my attention.
Yes.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Joanna, you had also sort of mentioned sort of skepticism with like, does Netflix have like the big top line project?
Like the auteur thing. So what are you looking
right,
at?
Right. That's, yeah. So, and they have a lot like, as has been the case the last several years, they've got like a billion projects out there, whatever, that like, and a lot of them, you can look at them as like maybe like acting possibilities. They're doing Blonde. So we talked about Ana de Armas and Blonde. There's Sandra Bullock is in a movie called Unforgiven, which I think is interesting because now that 30 years has passed, we can just like have titles for Best Picture winners that just like, it's a different, and she's somebody who's coming out of prison, and there's a lot of it feels like there's like character drama potential there. Lin-Manuel Miranda is directing Tick Tick Boom, which is, you know, a very, you know, sort of like well-loved musical from a from a sort of like a cult of musical theater fans for that. The new Jane Campion movie,
which has Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons together, which is, you know, for us Plemons Dunst watchers, is a huge draw.
And if you believe Variety, the Venice and Cannes are fighting over the Campion movie currently.
Oh,
interesting.
Also, there's a movie called The Starling, directed by Theodore Melfi, who directed St. Vincent, but also Hidden Figures. But I bring up St. Vincent because this stars Melissa McCarthy. It's Melissa McCarthy, Theodore Melfi dramedy, which, like, those were all the reasons why the year before St. Vincent, I was like, maybe Melissa McCarthy for this. I was very wrong. But also, if you read the plot to this, it's kind of the same plot as Penguin Bloom. The Naomi Watts gets a bird to symbolize her grief sort of movie, except this one is about a starling. And like, I don't know. Melissa McCarthy in a dramedy is always going to have my attention, especially now after Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is like, I feel like that's a sweet spot that she could really excel in. But I think the two, if I were to go for like the two Netflix movies that I think have the possibility to be like their big thing, one of them is the Adam McKay movie, Don't mm-hmm. Look Up, which is a comedy, which is not always, you know, an easy sell for Oscar. But the last two Adam McKay movies have been big hits with Oscar, even when nobody liked it, like Vice. But also The Big Short. This is DiCaprio. This is Jennifer Lawrence. This could be like a, you know, oh, right, Jennifer Lawrence is back.
Yeah, we talked on last year's episode. We were like, is this going to be the year that Jennifer Lawrence comes back?
Right,
and
right.
Maybe this will, because she's got another one like where she plays a soldier. Oh, Red, White, and Water from Lila Neugebauer, which is an A24 movie.
And then the plot of this one is essentially, I think it's DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence are both playing scientists. They have to go and like convince the public that an asteroid is coming to Earth and it's destroying them. And I'm like, oh, so scientists trying to convince a possibly disbelieving public that something bad is happening and they need to do something about it. Like, I can't imagine how that wouldn't have resonance here. But it's DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Streep's in this, Chalamet's in this, Cate Blanchett is in this, Ariana Grande's in this. Like, it's again, so many stars, how could they miss? But like,
Streep plays the president of the United States, by the way.
Does she really?
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. And then the other one is a Western called The Harder They Fall.
Yes.
Which is directed by James Samuel. And it is a Western with, as far as I can tell, either a mostly black cast or an all black cast. And this is, again, you know, Lakeith Stanfield, Regina King, Idris Elba, Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors, Zazie Beetz. I think Jonathan Majors is
He's possibly the lead of it.
And he's somebody who I could definitely see, like, oh, Jonathan Majors is having his moment, kind of a
little
thing.
Little Goldman listener, Jonathan Majors.
Yeah, Little Goldman, previous guest.
Who lived, where did they film, Katie, do you remember?
He was in New Mexico, right?
New Mexico. Lived in New Mexico for, like, all of the pandemic, because he was just, like, there. Yeah, I'm all for it. I'm all in. Get me on the Steven Yeun train, but make it Jonathan Majors this year.
Yeah.
That cast is like Emmy and Oscar buzz of the past 3 years, like all condensed into a single list of people. It's remarkable.
Well, and if there's a, you know, what the hell happened with Delroy Lindo's Oscar nomination for Defy Bloods streak out there, like he's, you know, he can be part of this too. And so I think of the Netflix movies, this one and the Adam McKay are probably the two I would keep an eye on
so far nothing from like the grandmaster of cinema, Alfonso Cuarón, Martin Scorsese, David Fincher, which, you know, those have like been very, you know, well regarded and in some level successful projects for them, but like maybe it's time to try something different.
I want to bring our attention to another movie I don't think we've mentioned yet. Maybe we talked about it last year, I don't remember, but what better way for Hollywood to say movies are back, movie stars are back, everyone come to the theaters, than for Warner Brothers to get an Oscar for Will Smith for King Richard, the biopic about Venus and Serena Williams' dad. I feel like that is like feels close to a slam dunk for a nomination, at least, if it's any good. The fact that it's directed by Reynaldo Marcus Green, who's a really interesting director, I think is promising. He also has the Good Joe Bell, the Mark Wahlberg gay rights movie that I actually kind of didn't mind when it was at Toronto, and they've now retooled it apparently. But I
I thought it came out.
No, they didn't end up putting it out.
Just played Toronto.
Yeah. It was going to come out, and then for this Oscar season, and then they decided to hold it because they made some edits. They changed the title. They added a song, I'm told. But anyway, I think of the two Reynaldo Marcus Green movies, King Richard with Will Smith kind of returning, you know, post he tried it with Concussion, a sports drama that didn't get him an Oscar nomination or win. Maybe this.
But Richard Williams is such a character in and of himself that like I could really see Will Smith doing some really entertaining.
Are the Williamses involved in this movie? This was my one hesitation.
I don't think I read something that they are not, but
because you can just imagine like very powerful people like Venus and Serena Williams like wanting to kind of like take charge in something like this and it for potentially making a less interesting story. Just, you know, it's about their family. But if you've got something, because, you know, I think someone who is ambitious to the point that he turns his daughters into like massive tennis stars is a fascinating story to tell. But you kind of need to see both sides of it, right?
I also wanted to mention that, you know, we were talking about Jonathan Majors in the other movie, who's in Lovecraft Country, as is Anjanou Ellis, who plays Venus and Serena's mother, also a coach in this movie. So,
yeah.
Well, speaking of famous people, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up Spencer, the Kristen Stewart is Princess Diana movie, which we've seen, I think, two still photos from it, which look amazing. And it's hard to get people pumped about still photos, but House of Gucci and Spencer seem to have that power. It's a Neon release, you know, Neon won Best Picture with Parasite. They had a pretty quiet year this past year. You know, for understandable reasons. So I'm very intrigued from what we see from that. And it's Pablo Larraín, who made Jackie, my beloved Jackie. Yeah. No one else is beloved Jackie but mine.
I love Jackie's, you know.
We're pro Jackie podcast.
Challenging Jackie.
Yes, exactly. One of the things that's harder to do with this year ahead podcast is to obviously see the smaller movies coming. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, Nomadland on the long list last year, but it was, you know, one of many possible small movies. But one I wanted to point out is the new Sean Baker movie called Red Rocket, which is about a washed up porn star who sort of returns to his home. And it's it seems to be a dramedy, and it stars Simon Rex, who people might remember from the early 2000s. He was an MTV VJ. He was on WB shows. He was in some of the Scary movies. But if you grew up gay and, let's say, maybe closeted in the late 90s, early 2000s, you also remember that he did some porn movies back in the day. And so there's going to be, he's the star of this movie. And when you have that sort of personal connection to a role from a possible kind of comeback story. I don't even know if you would call a Simon Rex story a comeback story, considering like the heights that he reached were never quite that high. But there's a story in there. And I think when you talk about Oscars, like, narrative matters a lot. And if this movie is good and his performance is good in a very sort of unexpected way, those things can sometimes sort of create their own momentum. Joe, and I did want to sort of get out.
I think
on
we
that.
Can safely say Simon Rex is a good shot to get an Indie Spirit Award nomination, which is a sentence I never thought I would say.
Listen, but I'll put my chips on it now.
Wait,
yeah,
can
absolutely.
I? Joe, was the WB show that Simon Rex is on Jack and Jill, starring Amanda Peet and
I think so.
Sarah Paulson?
He was also on Felicity for a while, but I think he was on. I think he was a regular on Jack and Jill.
I feel really good that my brain is holding on to that information.
Yes.
You didn't mention Ivan Sergei, though, so.
Oh, well, fair enough. Partial credit, then. Should we mention this Steven Soderbergh has a film?
I was just looking at that. It's right above Red Rocket on this list that Joe made for us. I wasn't aware of this at all, that it's a bunch of, like, Soderbergh all-stars coming back for a heist movie.
Let's read out the cast list, Katie. You have to.
It is Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro, Amy Simetz, David Harbour, John Hamm, Ray Liotta, Kieran Culkin, Noah Jupe, Brendan Fraser, Julia Fox, and Matt Damon. So some nice mix of old and new stars in there.
And this might let's just put a question mark on this being an interesting Brendan Fraser year. And this is why I'm gonna, because he's got this Darren Aronofsky project that he's also doing called The Whale. Which is described, it's A24, and it's a reclusive English teacher suffering from severe obesity who attempts to reconnect with his estranged teenage daughter for one last chance at redemption. And I just want to flag this because Brendan Fraser, not for no reason, because he is fantastic, has been massively adopted by Gen Z. They love Brendan Fraser. Yeah. They love talking about The Mummy. And so I think this is maybe I think we kind of thought it might happen with the FX series that he was, the Donald Sutherland FX series that he was a part of. But like, this might be like a time to really revisit Brendan Fraser. And
we'll see how Gen Z likes the Brendan Fraser giant fat suit movie, I am less excited about that angle of it.
Absolutely.
So, fat
suits in general, I am down negative on, but I am interested to see what this year does for his narrative.
Brendan Fraser calling out the HFPA before it was popular.
Love that for him.
I wanted to flag a couple of blockbusters since, as you know, as I keep saying, like, I feel like big movies are going to be in. Dune is this obvious big question mark we've had for a long time, which I don't know. Maybe we can do it the favor and not assign it Oscar buzz because it's going to be Dune.
That's
anyway.
Sort of what I want to do for it. Yes. Yeah. I'm excited for it for a billion different reasons, and I don't want to, you know, place that pressure on it. Not that I have the power to do that or not do that, but I think it can be a really good movie and still maybe not be an Oscar thing, and
yeah,
that's fine.
I think
me.
That's perfect. We should flag No Time to Die because, if nothing else, Billie Eilish's song, which came out, which was eligible for a Grammy this year, I think, because it did come out before the movie got delayed, which is wild.
Yes.
And then you can call me crazy if you want to, but like, there's a new Matrix movie coming out in December. The Wachowskis are fascinating people. And the Matrix continues to be like one of the most influential and important movies of the last 25 years. I don't know. Like, it's coming out at Christmas. This feels like a very old school Oscar buzz thing to be like, well, if it comes out in December, it has to have Oscar buzz. But a really good Matrix movie to come out at the end of, you know, 2021 could really hit if it works right.
Though I think, Joe, in the spreadsheet, you made a mistake because when it's listed in the cast for Matrix 4, Keanu Reeves, Carrie-Anne Moss, or Jada Pinkett, Priyanka Chopra, but then you have Jonathan Groff and Neil Patrick Harris, which that must have been from a different, like, there's a Ryan Murphy musical coming out or something, right?
Right.
They can't possibly be in a Matrix movie.
The Prom 2.
Right. Yes, exactly. They pulled them from The Prom 2. Yeah. Katie, I can't believe you didn't mention Venom, Let There Be Carnage as a Best Picture contender.
I still haven't seen
both filmed
Venom.
In San Francisco, by the way, Venom 2 and Matrix 4.
Shang-Chi, right? As we saw in the trailer.
Shout out to our tax breaks.
Do we want to talk about Marvel at all? Like, as we record this, they sent out this huge trailer of all the movies they've got coming for the next 5 years or something. This year is Eternals, which is Chloe Zhao, obviously, and Shang-Chi and Black Widow. Are those the three Marvel movies coming out this year?
Yep.
I think that's everything, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think this would probably not be the year to place your chips on a Marvel Best Picture nomination, but
probably not. I think if there's any one to sort of like keep an eye on, it's probably Eternals just because of the Chloe Zhao connection. But I think just getting people back into movie theaters and, you know, enjoying things in a crowded room again, like, will be victory enough if
that
we can do
reward.
That by the end of the year. Like, that would be great.
I think House of Gucci technically is also in the Avengers universe.
Right. Right. Right.
I thought that was a Thrones film spinoff.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I get it. The humans. The humans are part of the Avengers.
Do you see that Gucci Lisa throne. Joy is essentially making like Westworld the movie?
It's possible.
Lovely, lovely Lisa Jackman. Joy is making the, Hugh Jackman, it's called Reminiscence. Tandy Newton is there, Daniel Wu. A scientist discovers a way to relive your past and uses the technology to search for his long lost love.
That sounds like The Fountain, too.
Sort of. Yes, it actually does.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about like mainstream movies that like you might want to take a flyer on, and like I have no idea, but, Nia DaCosta's Candyman coming out at the end of August, which I always, always, always think of as the Sixth Sense slot, even all these many years later, with it's supposedly a spiritual sequel to Candyman. So and it's produced by Jordan Peele. So obviously Jordan Peele was able to get Oscar success out of Get Out. And, Lupita Nyong'o came pretty darn close to getting a nomination for Us. So like the pedigree is there. And again, sometimes all it takes is Oscar voters having an excuse to look at a movie as if it's an Oscar movie, even though it might, there might be, genre reasons for it and whatnot. And I think Candyman sort of like gets let in that door because of the Jordan Peele connection. And I'm really excited for this movie. And I really think it could be really good. And if it is, you never know.
Yeah.
We can't also count out Clint Eastwood, 90-something years old, has a movie called Cry Macho coming out.
Of course he does.
A Western. I think it's like a neo-Western kind of thing.
I texted this to Katie earlier today, but I can't stop seeing the title Cry Macho and not sing it in the Gran Torino voice.
Yeah.
Cry Macho.
I mean, that song, I'm sure, is in the end credits of this movie.
I made my own copy of Joe's spreadsheet and put my own little notes in the margin. And for that one, I put Never Count Out Clint. So I completely agree with you.
Also, it's about a former rodeo star, which just makes you think of the writer. So the Chloe Zhao influence continues onward. Oh, I did want to meant to talk about this at the beginning when we talked about In the Heights and West Side Story, but there's Tick, Tick, Boom, and then there's also Dear Evan Hansen in terms of giant musicals. It seems to be set for a September release, which in terms of if we're going by the old school rules of Oscar buzz windows, which I don't know how much those will apply anymore, seems to imply maybe it's more of a audience thing than an Oscar-y thing, but it was a big deal on Broadway, so it seems worth watching. And Julianne Moore, and Amy Adams both in it.
And Amy Adams. I was going to say, if we're going to have an Amy Adams narrative this year, it's going to be for this one because it won't be for Woman in the Window.
I won't speak for anyone else on this podcast. I'll let them speak for themselves. But I am pretty anti this musical. But I look forward to Ben Platt's Golden Globe nomination. That's going to be good time.
Yeah, I was going to say, critics really love Ben Platt in this show. And if that translates at all to film critics, then...
There are a couple things about that. One, he's way too old to play the role.
Yes, yes.
Two, Amy Adams and I don't know about Julianne Moore's singing voice, but I know Amy Adams can sing, but I think Julianne Moore is playing Evan's mom. And Rachel Bay Jones won a Tony for the big 11 o'clock number that that character has. It's not a huge belting song, but I don't know, that one, I'm kind of that could be weird. I think the other thing, and maybe it's what you were kind of alluding to, Joanna, is that there is, I count myself among them, a contingent of people who saw the show either off-Broadway, on-Broadway, or both, in my case, who I find that the kind of theme and message of that show really kind of toxic, actually. And it seemed to have survived that on Broadway because a lot fewer people are seeing things on Broadway. Mm. And even listening to the soundtrack, you might not get the full context of what the show is actually about. When it becomes a feature film that a lot more people can see and have access to, I think that movie needs to brace for a wave of backlash. People being like, this is what the show is about. It's about basically a guy tricking, a guy tricking a girl into dating him based on a really, really big, profound lie. And he's the hero of the story.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't want to speak for you, Richard, but Richard's hate for Dear Evan Hansen really sustains me in my hour of need.
The other thing is, though, too, the Ben Platt performance as sort of, Tony winning and beloved by a lot of people that it is an incredibly big tears and snot forward kind of a crying performance. There's a lot of expressed emotion in this role, which is great on stage, at least for a lot of people. Won't translate to film in the same way. And he's going to really need to, him and director Stephen Chbosky, who did Perks of Being a Wallflower, which is a movie I really, really liked. They're going to need to modulate a lot for film. And it's I'm not telling anybody anything that they don't know about that. And it'll be interesting to see how reined in that performance needs to be.
If he brings the same energy he brought to his seminal role in Pitch Perfect, and I'm not kidding, he's my favorite part of that movie, then,
Thought you were going to say as the gay bartender Meryl Streep Stan in Ricky and the Flash, which is my favorite film performance of his.
Okay, I feel like we should maybe do one lightning round of each of us throwing out one more title we want to mention before we do our best picture predictions, because we've been talking forever. Who would have guessed? So I'm going to start by defending the concept of Being the Ricardos, which is the Aaron Sorkin movie that has come in for some heat, because there are these set photos of Nicole Kidman looking, she doesn't look a lot like Nicole Kidman or Lucille Ball. I feel like that's fine. I think, Joe, you're with me in that, Aaron Sorkin will have me more interested than not by default. And I don't know, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz are a fascinating couple. Their relationship was hugely important to the shaping of American culture. I think there's potential there. That's all.
Nicole Kidman is one of the best actresses we have. I think I trust her to pull off a character. It's this idea, and again, Twitter is not the world and social media is, bad. But this idea that Nicole Kidman wouldn't be as good for the role as someone like Deborah Messing because she doesn't look enough like Lucille Ball is so much of what's wrong with the way a lot of people talk about movies these days, and especially about biopics. Like, I could give a shit if she doesn't look like Lucille Ball. I'm excited for the take on the character and the performance, and I have a lot of trust in Nicole Kidman, is all I will say.
That is wise. All right, Joe, what's your last thing you want to throw out?
I don't think that this is going to be a major, major contender, but I will say that the prospect of Joaquin Phoenix making a Mike Mills movie after 20th Century Women, which was one of my favorite movies of that year, has me excited for a Joaquin Phoenix movie, which I haven't been able to say in a while. So
the movie's called Come On, Come On.
Come On, Come On from A24. Yes. So into that.
Joanna, what's your last pick?
I got to shout out my fave Kay Cannon of my beloved blockers doing Cinderella with Camila Cabello, Billy Porter, Idina Menzel, Minnie Driver, John Mulaney, James Corden. You know what? It's weird. It's modern. It's a musical. I'm here for it.
It feels like we just did Cinderella. I mean, we did like four.
Yeah, but it wasn't a musical.
That's true. Is it the Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella or a different one?
I think it's totally different.
Yeah, it's
right?
Different music. Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. Okay, Richard, what's your last one you want to mention?
Have I talked about Cry Macho yet?
You gotta sing it though when you get into it.
No, I think we already talked about it post Sundance, but I think one big movie that I think from that festival that has chances if Netflix handles it right is Passing, particularly for Ruth Negus' performance. She's so good in that movie. I didn't love the movie as a whole, but I think she's really great and is one of those actors who I think is like an actor's actor. And so maybe, and you know, did get that Loving nomination. So it does indicate some support within the Academy.
And she would probably be a supporting contender, I would imagine, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That would be pretty cool. The other, not to like double dip, but if we're talking about supporting actresses, Vera Farmiga playing a younger Livia Soprano in The Many Saints of Newark isn't unintriguing to me. Like that's...
Alan Taylor, I don't know.
I'm going to double dip too because I thought Richard was going to say Coda talking about Sundance, which is picked up by Apple TV Plus. That was like the huge crowd pleaser for being a virtual Sundance. And Marley Matlin is also a supporting actress in that. She's an Oscar winner. She's really terrific in it. And I like that movie a whole lot. So I'm excited to see what happens. It's coming out in mid-August, aka The Help Spot.
Yeah.
So see how it goes from there. Okay. Guys, time to make your best picture predictions. As a reminder, I don't think anyone has ever gotten it right in this segment, but that is the fun of it. I can go first because I feel pretty good about mine. Does that work for everybody?
Sure.
Not that I feel like it's going to win, but I'm going to return to my old strategy where I make a prediction that turns out to be the best makeup winner the following year. So I'm going to go with The Eyes of Tammy Faye because when you think of Tammy Faye Baker, you think of makeup.
Get it.
I mean, Ma Rainey's makeup, I feel like, is a really similar vibe, and it just won the Oscar, so I don't know if that can happen 2 years in a row. I mean, Michael Showalter as a director is really intriguing. He did direct The Big Sick, which did get a screenplay nomination. He's made kind of a really big variety of movies beyond that. But I'm really intrigued as a South Carolinian. The Bakers are also from South Carolina, so I'm going to just shoot my shot and hope for the best.
Do it.
All right, Joe, what about you?
Well, I mean, I tweeted this on Oscar night, to sort of shoot my shot with it. And, you know, if it comes true, I will be happy and also correct, which also makes me happy. So that's nice. I said after that In the Heights trailer on Oscar night, I said In the Heights is winning Best Picture next year. And I'm just going to stand by it. I'm going to stand by it all year. I think we are ready for something big and emotional and communal. And I think that is all of those things. Again, my Twitter feed is not the world, but like the fever pitch that people are anticipating this, it could be a really, really big thing. I think John M. Chu, director, and Anthony Ramos and Olga Merediz as the actors in that could be contenders.
Olga Merediz being Abuela Claudia,
who
played the role on Broadway as well, right?
Yes. Saw this thing on Broadway back in the day. I loved it then. And if any year is going to be the year of the big community celebrating musical where we're all dancing outdoors and enjoying each other's company, like this would be the year. So,
yeah, I don't want to brag too much as a person who has seen it, but I do think it's going to be huge. And I was tempted to predict it myself. So
In the Heights,
baby. All right, Richard, how about you?
Well, only because I want to hear whoever presents Best Picture, be it Jane Fonda, Harrison Ford, Denzel Washington, whoever it is. I just want to hear them say Soggy Bottom. So I'm just going to put that. They're probably going to change the name of the movie. I don't know, but that's where I'm going for. It's Paul Thomas Anderson. He's due.
It's so rare that a Paul Thomas Anderson movie even has a title this far ahead.
Yeah,
almost
true.
Always, unless it's based on a novel, like it's almost always untitled Paul Thomas Anderson project until like the last minute.
I did like your tweet, Joanna, that there's movies called Stillwater and Soggy Bottom, but neither of them about the fictional bands from early 2000s movies.
Right. I was going to say, I hope whoever announces it goes like, it's the Soggy Bottom Boys, like when they win the Oscar. I don't know if it's illegal for me to do this, but I am going to double down on Joe's prediction with Paciencia y Fe and go with In the Heights. So,
you know what? If you guys both win, you have to just share the glory.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, with two Fine. Joes behind it, how can it not win? You know what I mean? So
it would be fascinating if, like, for the way the world has been turned upside down in the past year, if this is the year that two of you get it right on the Best Picture prediction.
It would be wild. Yes.
Well, I guess that does it for the show. You guys have anything else you want to throw out? Are you excited about this year in movie going? I think we maybe are all about to jump out of our seats, ready to go back to movie theaters.
Oh, yeah.
As is the case every year when I make this spreadsheet, which I've been doing for the last few years, even before making use of it for this podcast. It's so invigorating to see a spreadsheet with like 100 new movies mm-hmm. that are waiting there for me to see. It's like, especially again, after the longest Oscar season ever, we were talking about the same movies for like an even longer period of time. It's so exciting. There's so many movies, you guys, yeah. and I want to see all of them.
Yeah, I'm not kidding you. My friend is talking about renting a limo when we go see the new Fast and Furious movie. Yeah, yeah. Like it's prom. Oh.
Yeah, I for some reason actually is the Mission Impossible movie supposed to come out this year? Are they going to wait another year?
I think that's next year as well.
Okay,
I think
but
that's
then maybe I'll have to do that for like Top Gun Maverick or something. I'm just or yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Joe. We might have you back sooner than next year, but obviously we'll have you back again in a year to see how well we did. But I didn't really plug you at the beginning. So before I close everything out, Joe, plug where people can find you.
Oh, yeah. You can come listen to me and my co-host Chris File on the podcast This Had Oscar Buzz. We are currently in the midst of our annual May miniseries. We do a miniseries every May. This year, our focus will be on the films of Focus Features. We're doing 5 episodes on movies from our favorite soothing title card film studio. So upcoming episodes on The Place Beyond the Pines and Lust Caution and Boy Erased. We've already done The Muse and
Lust Caution is one of my favorite movies of all time. Ugh, I'm excited.
Oh, and Possession, the Gwyneth Paltrow movie Possession, which I hadn't seen up until this time.
Oh,
so.
that's half a great movie.
Yeah.
It's got a real Julia vibe.
Boy, that's a real spoiler for our conversation coming up, because that's sort of what we talked about. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, come listen to us. We are on Twitter at @had_Oscar_buzz. And, yeah, if you like this Oscar stuff, it's sort of right up that alley.
Oh, and I feel like I should say that if for some reason you missed it, but enjoy hearing Joe, that our 2000 Oscars flashback we did last November 4th, the week of the election, which was like one of the nicest, like wisest yeah. things I've done for myself in a long time. But you and Chris came on and we looked back at Gladiator and Aaron Brockovich, and that was a really fun episode that people should
great.
Go back
we
and
had
listen
a good time.
To. Well, in the meantime, you can find me and Richard and Joanna at vanityfair.com. We are on Twitter at @littlegoldmen, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich, and Joanna.
Joe wrote this.
And Richard.
Cry macho.
Yeah. Again, you gotta sing it, Richard. You gotta get that original
it's
song.
King
nomination.
Richard to you, yeah, okay, this Oscar season.
Not Richard the writer from Mayor of Easttown.
Right.
Yeah. And again, we didn't answer your subtext questions this week, but we will obviously continue doing that even in the post-Oscar season. So please text us. We love hearing from you. Join subtext.com/littlegoldmen, or you can text 917-809-7096. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best explanation for why our Oscar predictions don't match up with the Academy goes to Joe Reed.
It's a world that exists outside of our world.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.